So there are many, but I'll just give you three. So the first is your work does not speak for itself. So when you are the first person in your family to go to college and then enter a professional career, you have probably been told your whole life to keep your head down, work hard, don't cause any trouble, don't make any waves. And the assumption there is that your results will speak for themselves. And if you're lucky, your results will say something about you, but by no means is that a complete message. You have to advocate for yourself, advocate for the work you want to do, make yourself visible. So that's the first one.
Hi everyone, welcome to APCDA Podcast, a series of career-related conversation. The podcast in its sixth season in 2026 with the theme On the Mic with Thought Leaders. Today, we are very honored to have with us Michelle Hover. She's based in US. She's an executive coach and a leadership consultant. So without further ado, let us welcome her to the virtual stage to introduce herself. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Sam. Hi, Mike. Thank you so much for having me. I'm Michelle Y. Hoover. I am based in Connecticut in the United States. I'm a former New Yorker, was there for 17 years, and now in the suburbs and going through a bit of an identity crisis, but that's okay. I've spent the last 20 years helping people navigate and lead in organizations. I wasn't always in executive development. I actually began my career as a journalist. I began working as a paid reporter when I was 17 and did that for about 10 years. And then I decided to pivot. And while I knew I wanted to do something else, I did not know I wanted to do leadership development. I didn't know that there was a term for that, but that's what I ended up doing and love it very much. I've had my own business, my own consultancy, PEM Leadership, for the last 7 years. But prior to that, I was head of leadership development for an Amazon company, Audible, director of executive education for a Chinese business school, and head of product for a startup, an educational product startup. All of these experiences led me to see myself as a first generation professional, which was really personally enlightening and also was assisted by those 15 years doing executive development at the time. And that is my current project. I'm writing a book called From First to Fearless on First Generation Professionals. And I'm excited to talk to you about today.
Thank you. So, for anyone who is hearing the term for the first time, what is first generation professional and how is it different from first generation college student?
I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of your listeners haven't heard of this because it's a newer concept. I can't say that I coined it, but I can say that I'm trying to be synonymous with it. So, a first generation college student actually becomes a first generation professional after they graduate. We tend to stop talking about the first generation story after college because I think we have this, at least in the United States, we have this idea that education is a leveling playing field, and everybody goes out into the workforce with similar standing and a similar chance of advancing. But the fact of the matter is that a first generation professional is somebody who enters the professional world without inherited knowledge of how it works. And what I mean by inherited is maybe you grew up at a dinner table and you heard your parents talk about this meeting or that meeting, or they went on a business trip, or on the weekends they are doing something social with their boss or their coworkers, and you absorb and you learn how all of that plays into somebody's professional advantage. So first generation professionals are people who grow up without that.
I see. And I'm very interested. What got you interested with first generation worker? How do you develop interest in this area?
So at the time, I had about 15 years in leadership development and about 10 years in executive coaching. And while I love that work, and I always will, you just want to think about what else you can do. And I did two things simultaneously. It was during COVID. It was 2021, and I was just really thinking about my career and reflecting and just thinking about what would be an interesting problem to solve or interesting topic to surface. So that was one thread of conversation going on in my head. And the second was, man, I'm 40, whatever, and feel like it's been a long road and a bumpy road. And why is that? And is that because I'm from rural Pennsylvania? Is that because I had a certain upbringing? And then suddenly it was just nobody taught you how to navigate this world. Nobody taught you how to conduct yourself at a business meeting. People have been telling me to network forever, but I didn't know why. So these two ideas, like what are you going to do next? And, why has your journey been what it is? They converged upon realizing that I was a first generation professional, even though that term was not and still isn't widely known. I wanted to know whether this was something that I uniquely was experiencing. So while I'm not an academic, I do not have the patience, nor I think the attention span to complete a PhD, I did want to take somewhat of a scientific approach here. So I engaged an industrial organizational psychologist from Baruch College and his graduate student, and we developed a questionnaire and we started just taking people who identified as first generation professionals through that same interview protocol. And by the time we got to 30, we realized there are lots of common experiences here. And then that just opened the floodgates for this work for me.
Thank you, Michelle, for that overview. I think you mentioned some of us that work in academia and first generation college students. And as you alluded to, that term in academia has been around for a while, but I think you're doing a noble service by extending this concept by looking at first generational professionals, right? Sometimes, at least in academia, our efforts stop, or maybe not intentionally, but they graduate, we send them on their way, and sometimes we forget that first generation identity continues with them into the workplace. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more, maybe about some of your own experience and how you maybe came to embrace or at least explore that professional first gen identity within yourself.
Sure. So I'm the first American in my family. My family emigrated from South Korea in the 70s, and the family ended up in a coal mining town of Pennsylvania, of all places, because one of the aunts put down roots there. So there weren't a lot of Koreans around. And as the first American, and as somebody who started speaking English as easily as I spoke Korean, I was a representative for my family in many situations. I was making doctor's appointments. I think I was booking plane tickets. I think once I called the utility company, I filled out my own information for my social security card at age 7 or so. That was nothing to me at the time, but in hindsight, I realized, wow, I matured really fast and I learned how to absorb a lot of responsibility and understand that I was not just representing myself, I was representing my family. And that takes a little bit of, when you're 7, a little bit of moxie and a little bit of confidence as well. I see that influencing how I conduct myself professionally, in that I never had an issue. Interestingly, I had a problem speaking up in meetings when it's a smaller group, but I never had an issue standing up in front of the room and facilitating a session. And I've always taken my work extremely seriously. You could say that I'm a perfectionist or a recovering perfectionist. Just knowing that background of filling out government forms is something that never really escapes my mind.
Yeah, thank you. It kind of reminds me of a form of capital you were referring to, having parents that knew people at workplace or certain connections. And I think it's that type of social and cultural capital that's important, but it's a privilege also, right? And sometimes first generation students and workers don't have that same level of access. What they do have is, and I think this is what you're getting to when you're talking about calling the utility company on behalf of your parents, is the navigational capital, which is an asset that a lot of first generation students and professionals have. I
Yeah.
appreciated you sharing a little bit about your story. I want to go back. You had mentioned that you started out as a journalist and had worked in kind of the publication industry for a while. And then you transitioned moving into executive education and coaching. I was wondering if you could reflect on how you see those two different worlds connecting, right? Sometimes we
Yeah.
don't know they're connecting at the time, but when you look back, you can connect the dots. Maybe you can help us explain the connection of the dots in terms of your own career pathway.
Sure. And at the time when I was going into exec ed, it totally did not make sense. But now, in reflecting, it absolutely makes sense. So I think the three pillars of my career, as far as the things that I like to focus on, are people, storytelling, and communication. And I think that those are pretty obvious in terms of how those three things show up in journalism. You're focused on people. The service, the act of being a journalist, is for the people. It's the fourth estate. So just the idea that you are granted that responsibility and trust to serve people and to get their stories right in serving them was always something that really appealed to me. And I think executive education, or any education, when it boils down to it, effective education is a result of clear communication, and storytelling is a form of communication. So I think that all of this actually roots from the fact that I wanted to be an English major. I wanted to be an English major. But when you're the first American in your family, your parents are really worried about helping you pay tuition. You can't say, I don't know what I'm going to do after I graduate with an English degree. So that's why I became a journalist. At least I could say, yes, I'm going to work for a newspaper. And that was enough for them to know that I would be able to pay my bills.
Thank you. Samantha, any thoughts or reactions so far to what Michelle's shared with us at this point?
Yeah, so she's earlier on, you mentioned that you work with a professor and students to come up with the survey. And then by the time you hit 30, you realize that there are so many common experience. So I'm curious, when you realize that being first wasn't just a story, but a pattern shared by many other people, how does that make you feel?
A great question. Honestly, it was like, I knew it. I knew it. It wasn't just me. Because I think there are lots of ways that people connect with people. And when we had that realization, I thought about it. I always wondered, why do I get along better? Or why do some conversations with people seem easier than others? And all of my mentors, the people who have had a big part in my professional life, have all been first generation professionals. But at the time, we just said, oh, we're similar in so many ways. We like the same things. But I think underneath that, you have the same kind of values. You have the same kind of appreciation for somebody's journey. Even if you're not talking about it explicitly, you can just tell that you have traveled similar roads.
Okay, what do you think are some of the most important unwritten rules of a professional life, especially if experienced by first generation, that no one tells you and everyone assume that you should already know?
Yep. So there are many, but I'll just give you three. So the first is, your work does not speak for itself. So when you are the first person in your family to go to college and then enter a professional career, you have probably been told your whole life to keep your head down, work hard, don't cause any trouble, don't make any waves. And the assumption there is that your results will speak for themselves. And if you're lucky, your results will say something about you, but by no means is that a complete message. You have to advocate for yourself, advocate for the work you want to do, make yourself visible. So that's the first one. The second is that relationships are not extracurricular, they are part of the work. So back to that first idea. I'm just going to put my head down and do my work and focus on creating a great work product. That is what a first generation professional is naturally oriented towards. But if we think about how actually the professional world works, there is a lot riding on who you know, who can speak for you, who can advocate for you in a room you're not there, who can expose you to opportunities that you didn't even know about. So networking or establishing relationships might feel uncomfortable to a first-gen professional for many reasons, but primarily, I think the first one would be, well, they don't know why they need to do it. And the third is the criteria for advancement change as you advance. So what got you promoted from an individual contributor to a manager is a certain set of qualities. And then going from manager to director is another set of qualities and characteristics, and so on and so forth. And first-gen professionals, we're so inclined to figure out or learn how to do things the right way and just repeat that process and stay the course. Where in actuality, in a corporate or a professional environment, the game is always changing and you've got to understand how it's changing and not be playing a game that has rules that do not apply at this next level you're trying to get to.
Thank you, Michelle. I think the first one, your work does not speak for itself. You have to advocate for yourself. For some reason, it hit me pretty hard. I can feel for it. Yeah. Michael, how about you? Because you're working so much with young talents all this while in career development. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts right now. I'll just try and summarize one or two. I think to go back to storytelling, Michelle, in terms of your own narrative, I think that's really important. Many of us that are on this podcast and listeners in the career development space are starting to use more narrative approaches to working with clients and including students and also in executive coaching. And I think being able to tell one's story is going to become even a more valuable skill than it is already. And so the fact
Totally.
that you were able to identify that for yourself, in some ways, you are ahead of the curve because I think we're going to need to, as educators, we're going to need to prepare our students for multiple career shifts, life career. We define career as a constellation of paid and unpaid life roles, so not just paid work. And so I think that storytelling competency is really important. The other question that I had, sort of in the spirit of talking to other career development professionals, is what do you think those of us that work, let's say in university and college spaces with students and support first-gen students, what should we be doing? What should we know to maybe better, even better support our first-generation students as they make that transition from college to career?
Yeah. Well, first, I think a lot of respect needs to go to higher ed for all the strides made in the last 15, 20 years, getting first-gen students recognized and getting their needs understood. And that's so much work and it's so important. And Mike, is it right that getting them graduated within 6 years is the goal?
That's important. A lot of the sort of data points look at a 6-year graduation rate in terms of retention data.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So knowing that so many first-gen college students have so many decks stacked against them, just getting them there is a huge accomplishment. That said, I think if we're thinking more about what higher ed can do to help first-gen college students once they leave, is to adopt the understanding that building a career requires a very specific kind of education. And I think higher ed does what it can in terms of helping students land their first job through resume workshops, interviewing events, networking. But there are so many opportunities to help first generation professionals get exposed to what they encounter after they graduate in the professional world when they are first generation college students. So, what can we be doing earlier in terms of helping them understand why you need to build relationships? How do you respond to getting feedback? How do you get your work visible? These are things that are going to sound like Greek to them, and I fully appreciate that. So I think the conduit for getting that information across is alums or professionals who were also first generation college students who can speak to their own experiences and share everything they didn't know and the things they had to learn the hard way.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I think about some of the language that we use in higher ed. And Samantha, I don't know if this is true in Singapore educational context as well, but here in the United States, at least in the past, we've used what I would call deficit language, like at-risk first-gen student population. And unfortunately, sometimes we still hear and read that in higher ed literature. And we're really trying to move away from that and really look at first-gen students and first-gen professional workers from an asset-based approach and language. And along those lines, Michelle, I'm wondering, I mentioned or alluded to this idea of navigational capital that a lot of first generation students and workers have. What other, maybe identify two or three other strengths or assets do you feel first gen professionals have as they enter the workforce?
Yeah. So in April of 2023, the consulting firm BCG actually released a study on first generation professionals in Europe. And that study found that they are 32% more likely to be loyal to their employers and 40% more likely to be intrinsically motivated. And that makes perfect sense if you take into account that they're the first people in their families to have the opportunity to achieve what they have. So not only are those admirable qualities, but they are attractive traits to be known for in terms of employers. Employers should understand that this population is more likely to stay. But as far as the capabilities that I see over and over again in first-gen professionals, incredible resourcefulness, problem solvers, they just know how to get stuff done. They're accustomed to figuring things out without a roadmap. Secondly, I would say they're excellent observers. So a lot of my work is with big law, and firms these days are really investing in getting the first gen professional experience understood inside the firm, mainly because the pipeline of self-identified first generation professionals from law schools is very evident. So I set up a Google alert in 2023 and I got the most hits for first generation professionals in articles from law schools. So knowing law schools were identifying first gen professional, you send a pipeline to people into their jobs who already know to identify as a first gen professional. So as a result, law firms are getting caught up in terms of understanding what this identity experience means and what the implications are for their work performance and what they need in a workplace. And I bring up big law because I did a co-presentation with one of my clients at a conference in April, and he said that we bring in first gen professionals because they're great at asking questions and they're great at relating to witnesses who perhaps somebody who did grow up with that kind of working class background can't. So the way that a first gen professional, perhaps from a blue collar background, just that informs how they relate to people and what kinds of questions they ask. And I also see a particular kind of ambition. It's not loud. It's not achievement oriented. It's not accumulation oriented. It's more expressed as responsibility to family or community or the people coming up behind you.
Just so you asked me about whether is it similar in where I am in Singapore. So I was just reflecting, and I would have to say that across Asia Pacific in general, that there's really a lot of rapid growth, which means to say we are really seeing a lot of people who are probably the first in their family to be in a global company, in a white collar career. So I'm not so sure if I ever pay so much attention to how are they really feeling about their identity. Because over here, it feels as if we are constantly navigating with our own respective cultural values. In certain society, there is respect for hierarchy. There is being modest. You don't talk about how good you are. You are constantly looking at how bad you are. And there's also that family obligation that my family maybe took on debts to put me to college. I have to do well. I have to, so many obligation. So it's compared to what some of us are being exposed to, whereby you need to advocate yourself, especially when we learn from our Western friends. Now, so I'm very curious for Michelle, how would you coach people to bridge that, the cultural side, their values without losing themselves?
Yeah. It's interesting because you're explaining what is happening across the world in Asia. And I don't think it's that dissimilar from the first generation college students here. So let's just take, for example, a first generation college student who comes from a working class family in Queens, New York. Father has a blue collar job, mother doesn't work. And this professional goes out into the world and his family no longer understands him. He loses his accent and he forgets who he is. And sometimes his behavior goes against everything they taught him. So in Asia, I can t being Korean American, I can just get a little of a sense of how that impacts you. But I think the first message is that you don't have to change. Nobody, least of all you, wants to change because so much of what you grew up with can be the roots of your success. So there's no need to shed all that has worked for you. I think the way that we go about it in our coaching sessions is we ask the question is of what is the function of the behavior? So if you are self-advocating for the pomp and circumstance of it all, and to get attention, that's one thing. But are you self-advocating so that you can scale the corporate ladder? That is a very different purpose. So being able to differentiate the rationale for that behavior and explaining that could be helpful. And could also look for culturally congruent ways of doing things. So, for example, back to self-advocacy. If you have a hard time doing that as an individual, advocate for your team. Put your team first and make them the star. And don't ignore your contribution entirely. Make it clear that this is your team and they were guided by your direction. But you're not shining the light on yourself, at least first. You are getting them as in front as the star. And we coach a lot around the concept of hierarchy. We know hierarchy, and especially in Asia, it's a gerontocratic society. So pushing back against your boss is two strikes because that's your boss and they're older than you. So
Yes.
that's a double whammy. That has been the toughest, but the conversation we have around that is that respecting hierarchy doesn't mean making yourself invisible. So, how do you disagree respectfully, which means you're not saying, no, you're wrong. You are softening that in a way that makes clear that you perhaps don't agree with the thing being discussed, and you absolutely respect where this person sits relative to you in society.
Thank you, Michelle. You helped me answer my second question. You know, I was about to ask, how do we help someone to approach self-advocacy with keeping their heads down and be grateful? And I think what you mentioned was very, I think it's very applicable in the region that I'm in. You don't have to advocate for yourself first. If you feel so uncomfortable with the limelight, you can work as a team because community is a very deeply ingrained value in most of the Asian culture. And disagree respectfully, I think this is where higher ed will have to come in. They have to start to learn how to. This is very soft skill focused, I feel.
Yeah, it's not easy.
It's
It's
definitely
not
not
easy in
easy.
Asia.
Yeah, there's a lot of mindset barrier to cross. I imagine they have to start going against everything that they knew or everything that they were taught when as they were growing up. So very interesting. Michael, how are you
I
on the
want to
other
go back.
side?
Yeah, good. I'm just listening and taking this all in, and I'm thinking about, Michelle, some of your comments about differences between cultures in terms of some of our career message, and certainly even the foundation of career development is grounded in a very sort of white Western approach, right? Just be individualistic, set your goals high, keep moving forward, maybe don't consult with others or consider family or community. And I think that doesn't always align with other non-Western approaches. And so I'm even thinking about some of the career advice that we give here in the States about just network, go out there and find a mentor. Samantha talked a little bit about advocating for yourself. And there's an inherent assumption that, first of all, that students already know this. And then secondly, for first gen workers and students, that these values, these messages align with them as human beings. And that, of course, is not always the case. And so I'm wondering, as a coach, as a professional, how do you negotiate that with your clients? If that makes sense. If these messages don't resonate, how do you work with them to obviously move forward, but again, do it on their terms?
It doesn't resonate because they don't know why they need to do this. Like, why do I have to network? Are you just encouraging me to make friends, or why do I want to make myself more visible? Because if I stick my neck out, then there's more that they can criticize. And why would I do that when I'm trying to protect my standing in this job that I have that I work so hard for? So first, it's helping them understand where this is coming from and why this is a critical skill. This is akin to you doing the nuts and bolts of your job. So if you're an engineer, you're great at math and you're great at computing something, and you got to be great over here if you want to get promoted in terms of finding the right people who can shine a light on your work. So the first is to explain the function of the advice. And I offer play by play or minute by minute sometimes guides for the first gen professionals who are approaching a difficult conversation. Even something like offering them an opening and introducing why we're having this conversation is what they need. It's valuable to them and it helps them just get out of that place of inertia so they can see where the conversation is going. When you're asking somebody to have a feedback conversation in a managing up kind of situation, that's terrifying for a first-gen professional, and they have no idea how to start that. So we role play. I help them understand what the manager is likely thinking in that situation. If we've been coaching for a while, chances are I have a very good idea of the kind of experience this manager has shared with the person that I'm coaching. So just generally like double clicking and getting a couple layers down and explicitly providing a step-by-step guide or even a script, something to work from so that they know why they're having this conversation or they know why they're engaging this behavior and they know they have some idea of how it could go.
That's great. And I know that you've been doing a fair amount of writing about some of these concepts. And I want to, Samantha and I are both interested in some of your recent pieces. Your essay was titled, You Made It and You're Waiting for It to Fall Apart. Was that the title? Did we get that
Oh,
right?
yeah.
Yeah. And
As
then, of
bleak as
course,
that
your,
sounds, yes, it is.
yeah, no, it's, I think it's striking. We both want to know a little bit more about, I think you have a regular Substack column. I know you've written about family and a very poignant piece about your mother. Talk to us just a little bit about how your the writing process and how you're moving forward with that part of your work, if you'd be willing to do so.
Oh, of course. Michael, I told you I wanted to be an English major. So I'm totally like in my happy when I'm writing my Substack. So, first of all, this is my second go around with Substack. I first started, I think, in 2022 with absolutely no idea what I was doing. So I was just throwing stuff out there and basically sharing the learnings that I got from the interviews that we were doing. And because we were putting this thought leadership into the world, I took a really clinical, like in my head, the mental model was the CDC. You don't know who wrote it, they're providing information out there. And that is completely not how you do Substack. So this second round, I got some help from somebody who really knows what they're doing on Substack. And what works there and what engages people is their familiarity with you and their ability to relate to you. So I struggled with that initially because I'm still trying to get first generation professional out there and understood. So I'm taking on that kind of like teacherly way of doing things. And then as I did it and as I kept doing it, and the kinds of responses I was getting from readers, as those responses were coming in, those responses were personal. Wow, this explains something to me in a way that I've never comprehended before, or I feel seen. And As I gave more talks about this, people were coming up to me, sometimes with tears in their eyes, and saying, I finally feel seen. And oh my gosh, this explains everything. And as I got that feedback, I was just thinking, they're giving me so much by sharing these very personal experiences so openly with me. Maybe I ought to do the same. So I just started writing what felt natural to me. And as you read, last week was the 11-year anniversary of my mother's passing, and just and I embarrassed her, and I embarrassed her because I was a first generation professional that was developing as a first generation professional, and I was like louder than I should have been, and free spirited with my thoughts, and not exactly compliant always. But there are ways to intersect something that felt very personal, like grieving that, with what I'm working on. And if there are opportunities to show that I am a first generation professional too, and I'm so invested in this topic because I know of what the clarity of that lens has done for me. So I think at the beginning, I was just consumed by that because I wanted to provide the clarity of the lens to the millions of first generation professionals who are out there. And just as I went on, I realized, okay, the clarity maybe will be helped by people being able to relate to you faster. So that is why I've been writing about more personal things.
Yeah. I'll have to thank Michael for sharing the last article with me when you wrote about your mother. And I think one sentence really hit me. You wrote, she didn't have to recognize herself in me to be proud of me. I thought it was a very simple sentence, but I really felt for it. I could feel the words, the emotion behind the words you put in. So I thank you for writing this article. I really like it. And
Oh,
on the
thank you.
topic of writing, because you earlier on you mentioned that you are embarking on a new book, Fierce to Fearless. So I do not know how much you can share with us, as much as you can. What does the title means, and who are you actually writing this book for?
So the title of the book is From First to Fearless: Unlocking the Superpowers of First Generation Professionals, a Guide, a Mirror, and a Manifesto for Those Who Are First and Refuse to Be the Last. And Mike, I'm back to your concept of storytelling and how I think it's going to be a critical skill. And I think it's going to be an especially critical skill for first-gen professionals relative to that deficit framing that had become commonplace. Because the thesis of the book is those things that we interpreted as disadvantages may have been at the time, but they created traits and they created just characteristics that, if reframed in your brain, could be your superpowers if you knew how powerful they actually could be. So, for example, so for a kid who feels like they're behind because they didn't have a summer internship, because they had to work a second or third job because their grandmother needed her medication paid for. In a deficit framing, that person might be forthright about that in an interview and say, yeah, I couldn't do that because, or I didn't get an internship because I was working, and that's why I have a really strong work ethic. What if we help them reframe that and say, actually, I was not able to have an internship because I was working a retail job to support my family's finances, and that's how I learned to become a leader. It's a completely different narrative that kid can own. And that is the purpose of the book. From First to Fearless is about, number one, naming first generation professionals and helping first generations be seen, and helping them recognize that which they have gone through is character building in the best way. And knowing that our work tendencies are to hold back. Let's really analyze why and where we hold back and rethink those conditions and those characteristics and traits as fuel and the capabilities that can help launch you to a trajectory that you probably didn't know was possible for yourself. And the subtitle is about just the millions of us who are in this community and have no idea that we are first-gen professionals. And a hypothesis that I'd like to prove later is that I think the first-gen community is extremely empathetic and perhaps even loyal to each other. A first-gen can relate to a first-gen almost immediately because we just know what it took and we would do anything we can to make somebody else's path a little more smooth. So ideally, a first-gen professional in a senior role who was looking to hire would look to their alma mater for those first-generation college students and develop some kind of loop where the higher ed system is preparing these first-gen college students to enter the workforce, and the person who can hire is aware of that. So I think a lot of first-gen professionals do feel a great responsibility to be there for the folks coming up behind us.
It's
I
true.
love.
There's quite a fair bit of individuals in this part of the world doing their best to pay forward to the community. So I definitely can understand that part of building that ecosystem, building that community.
I was just going to commend you, Michelle, on the subtitle, and the key word that sort of stuck out for me is superhero, right? Or seeing it as a superhero skill. And I think that ties back to looking at first gen students and first gen workers in particular as an asset, right? There was a publication that came out, maybe it was like 15 or 16 years ago, and it was kind of before this increased attention on first generation college students and how best to support them. And in some of the early language, as I alluded to earlier, it was almost as if first generation students were a problem. And this author was saying, it's important to see first generation students as pioneers, not problems, right? And I would extend that to your concept in terms of promoting and supporting first generation workers, is seeing them as pioneers. Certainly they're first in the family, but as you said, there's a shared community and a sort of a kinship between fellow first generation workers.
Okay. So when we were doing those 30 interviews, that first batch of interviews, one of the questions towards the end of the survey, so we interviewed two groups. So people who were in the beginning, middle of their careers, and people who were maybe in the last third and they could see retirement in the future, in the near future. And one of the questions we asked that second group was, as you reflect on your career, what has been the most gratifying part of your experience? And almost all of them said helping younger people develop into stronger employees or better leaders or whatever it is. And I looked at the transcripts and not quite verbatim, but the theme was there. These folks felt like they had not an obligation because that sounds forced, but it was top of mind for them that this was part of their job or a part of a good manager and a good leader's job. And that is not a trait that is universal among people who lead people. So that is where that hypothesis came from. And just knowing the people who have influenced me and have been a big part of my professional development, all first generation professionals. So yes, I do believe that there's a special kinship among us.
Before we go into our last couple of questions, I want to follow up on the book. Can you give us kind of a sneak preview as to when we might expect it? Where might listeners be able to purchase it?
Sure. When I know, you all will know. If you go to my website, michelleyhoover.com, there is a place where you can sign up for the early reader list.
Samantha and I have a special feature that we do at the end of each of our episodes. And from the previous speaker, they contribute a question to the following speaker. So a couple months ago, we interviewed coach and entrepreneur Eric Sim, who's also based out of Singapore. And he had this question for you. He didn't know it was coming to you specifically, but since you're the next speaker, you get it. Okay.
Awesome.
And then you'll have a chance to come up with a question that we'll then pose to the following speaker. So here was Eric's question. He talked a lot about chance events. These are occurrences in your own work life that maybe you didn't anticipate, but it turned out positive in some way and impacted your trajectory. So he asks, can you describe an experience or an occurrence in your own life that was, in retrospect, a chance event that led to something positive? What was it, and how do you make sense of it now?
I had fun thinking about this question. So, when I was 17, there was a nationwide journalism scholarship program sponsored by Dow Jones. And they would select 30 rising seniors from around the country to go to journalism boot camp. And 15 were going to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and 15 were going to San Francisco State University. And you did not express a preference. But in my head, I had a preference, and I wanted to go to Carolina because they were known at the time to have an incredible journalism program. Mind you, I didn't have the access or resources to understand whether SFSU also was a great program, but it had to be because that's they hosted 15 of us. So I was just really hoping to get to Carolina. And I get the letter. And the first thing I think is, oh my gosh, I was selected. It was like, I'm going to San Francisco and I really want to go to North Carolina. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, think about that now. And I'm like, what were you thinking? So the chance event was going to San Francisco on my own at age 17. So the scholarship included a 3-week stay in a campus apartment on the SFSU campus, being taught by Associated Press reporters and radio and TV reporters. So that was the formal training. But being in San Francisco, one of the most diverse cities in the world, and home to a huge Asian and Asian American population. I'm from a coal town in Pennsylvania where my family essentially makes up the population of Asian folks there. I go to San Francisco. I see a ton of Asian people. I see people salsa dancing on a Friday afternoon because that's what you do in this town square type place. I have my first burrito. I meet people from around the country. My roommates, I'll never forget. Anita Benita Friesen from Detroit, Michigan, Heather Hill from Chillicothe, Ohio. We had nothing in common and everything in common. And I think that's where I just realized, oh my gosh, like this is the world that I want to be a part of. And I am so thankful that I got exposed to that world and that kind of possibility. Like when you're dreaming, when you're like 15, you'll think, well, you might want to be one of 30 kids selected for a nationwide journalism scholarship and you go somewhere. So the fact that this was made available to me, I got selected and I got to go to one of the most vibrant cities in the world, meet people who are nothing like me, and just had the best, most formative time ever.
That's powerful. Thank you for sharing that. I can see where that was a chance event where you initially thought, oh, I wanted to go to Chapel Hill, but then this wonderful experience opened up in front of you.
Yeah. It
Samantha,
sounds
any
very
reactions?
magical. It sounds very magical. I was just smiling when she was just talking and memorizing the experience that she had. So here's your chance, Michelle. If you have a question for our next speaker, what would you ask?
Sure. Along the lines of my subject matter interests, what's something you understand about how careers work now that you wish somebody had explained to you when you were 22?
All right, cool. Yeah,
Okay.
that's a really good question. Before we wrap up, is there any things that you'd like to share with us before we close? Perhaps maybe how can we even reach you if we want to find you?
Sure. My book website for From First to Fearless is michelleyhoover.com. And from there, you will see a link to my Substack. I publish there every Wednesday. So if you subscribe, you will get my newsletter in your inbox every Wednesday morning Eastern time.
Wonderful. And then information about the book would also be on your, I would assume, on your website and other promotional
Yeah, can't
things.
wait to get my hands on the book because I think it's very relatable to a lot of people that I work with in this region because we have never thought about it this way and we have never associate that kind of identity or recognize that kind of identity. And I can imagine embracing that identity could do wonders for our career, as whether is it working with the students or even a seasoned professional. So once again, thank you, Michelle, for sharing with
Thank
us
you.
this insight and going in depth with this term that we probably didn't know until this episode. So I really appreciate your time and your sharing.
Thank you so much, Sam and Mike, for the invitation. It was lovely to be with you, and I look forward to reconnecting down the road.
That was a
Yes.
very insightful session. Michael, thank you for introducing Michelle to us because I really honestly never had any clue about first generation professional and everything that she talks about, how she defines it, and some of the traits and characteristics are things that I witness day in and day out in my environment and something that I was so ignorant about. So I'm very grateful that I had this conversation with her. How was the
Yeah.
session for you?
It was really engaging, and I had kind of connected with Michelle through social media, but never really had a chance to meet her or talk to her. So it was a really engaging conversation. And I think you're right. I think there are probably going to be a number of listeners who are maybe aware of first generation college students, but maybe not this concept extended further to the workplace or first gen workers, as she titles it. What were one or two main ideas, Samantha, that you're going to walk away with after a conversation with Michelle?
I think some of the things that she talked about, she gave three tips, all right? And one of
Yes.
the tips that she gave was your work does not speak for itself. And usually you don't think that way. Usually your work will speak for itself when it comes to competence. But the idea of
Right.
her saying that work does not speak for itself is because there is a very crucial element to self-advocacy. And that could be something that is missing in some of the people that we work with, whether is it young talent or seasoned professional, first generation or not, I think at the end of the day, some of us are not thought about this thing called self-advocacy. So this was something that I took away, and I think this is something
Yeah.
that I can use in my practice. How about you?
Yeah, I have 2 pages of notes here. I don't know where to start, but there are a couple of points that I think resonated for me. Second point, I think it was the second point where she talked about the importance of relationships for first generation workers and that being an important and critical part of one's work. And then another part that she, or another feature that she talked about, I think it was when we were talking about what are assets, right? So moving away from deficit language, and we talk about first generation workers to asset based. And she talked about this idea of first generation workers being problem solvers. That really stood out for me, as well as observers who ask questions, right? I know with some of my own students, I talk about the trait of curiosity, right? And I want my students, even want my own kids to be curious, right? I want them to be engaged in their learning, to ask questions of others. And I think sometimes maybe we assume that everyone has that trait or has that skill, but it really is a talent. And you know the people that are good at that versus some of the people that just don't have that skill set quite yet. So I think kind of that asset-based approach of really focusing on the problem solving, being good observers, and asking questions, especially within a workplace, are all thoughtful contributions.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, besides that, I also think it's a muscle. It's a muscle to be trained. Some of the
Yes.
qualities, the characteristic and traits, sometimes we may forget that we have that and we forget to train that because we want to cover it up. So I thought that bring awareness that that first gen has that characteristic and traits and how to positively utilize them
Yeah.
was very insightful. And I can't wait for her book actually, because I can
Yeah.
imagine in her book she will probably go in depth with more strategy, more tips, and more of her findings that she has when
Yeah.
she worked with her clients. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm interested in the 30 interviews that she did that's going to comprise the basis of the book. And I was also very grateful that she was able to be just so transparent and authentic with us, talking about some of her writing. And she wrote about her mom and the grieving process. I think she said it was the 11-year anniversary this past week or so. And she
Yeah.
was just forthcoming and genuine with us. And I think that was a gift. I appreciated that from Michelle.
Indeed, I love that article. Thank you for sharing. So I
Yeah.
think I can't wait for the full episode to be out, whereby our listener can get to learn more about something that all of us are so intrigued by.